Lamentations chapter 2 is where we are tonight. As on the Sunday nights, we go through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. The book of Lamentations is made up of five poems, funeral poems really, written by the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah was forced to watch in his calling by God as prophet to the southern kingdom of Judah and Jerusalem. He was forced to watch the death, really, of Judah. And they died because they were unwilling to turn away from their sin. And so Jeremiah writes these five poems encapsulating that. As we saw last time when we were together, one of the things that's glaring in its absence in modern society, at least in the United States of America, is a faithfulness and a responsibility to show the consequences of sin and the consequences of rebellion against God. And it's rarely shown, and it's rarely taught in human lives. We don't need to have people raise their hands, but how many of us, we did not know the consequences of sin that wasn't taught to us in our childhood, it wasn't taught to us in different environments. And I mean, not to look for a scapegoat or anything like that, but I mean, some of us came into adult life as very much a blank slate. And it was only through catastrophe and failure that we began to learn the lessons that sin is a terrible thing, that it's a hard thing on a human life. And that God is always faithful to warn about the consequences of sin. And that's what the book of Lamentations is. It's a microscope that gets put over the city of Jerusalem following its destruction by the Babylonians to drive home the point that the way of the transgressor is hard and that the path of sin is a disastrous path for us to choose to put ourselves on. And there's tremendous destruction, tremendous damage that occurs, not only to the city of Jerusalem, but to individual human lives as a result of rebellion against God. I like in the book of Hebrews, where the writer of the book of Hebrews speaks about some of the great patriarchs of the Old Testament. And in chapter 11, he talks about Moses, who, when he became of age, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. In the old King James, it was the pleasures of sin for a season. And the sin is pleasurable to the flesh. It's pleasurable. But it is only for a season. And it is a very short season. And it is not worth the season that follows it. And that's one of the lessons of this great book. So poem number two, also an acrostic, 22 verses corresponding to the succeeding 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He has cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. One of the words, phrases that you'll see repeated over and over again in the second poem is the old King James, he hath, he hath, he hath, he hath. And the new King James, the Lord has, the Lord has, the Lord has, the Lord has. One of the problems with rebelling against God is that there is, as we saw in chapter 1, or poem number 1, there is just the consequences of sin that the sin dishes out, that the world dishes out, that the devil dishes out. But for the child of God, it's a double whammy because it's not just that consequence, but God must now become involved in disciplining me and chastening me to get me off that path. And so now this second chapter is about the anger of the Lord being brought against Jerusalem, and he did not remember his footstool, and that's probably a reference to the temple. Could be a reference to Jerusalem as a whole, but a reference to the temple where in the Psalms, the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy of Holies, the temple itself is referred to as the footstool of the Lord. And so he had to forsake it in the day of his anger. The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied all the inhabitants of Jacob. He has thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughters of Judah, and he has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. And so God here had, because of their rebellion, he had to swallow up and throw down the cities of Judah. Now, once the cities became full of sin, and that's what they did, the cities of Judah became filled with idolatry, and the cities were prosperous, and they were using their prosperity to buy more idols and to get involved in even greater idolatry. And so in order to bring this whole cycle to an end, God brought judgment upon those individual cities, and because the idolatry permeated the land, he had to judge all of the cities, even Jerusalem. Verse 3, he has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel. And the horn was a symbol of someone's strength. So he's cut off the strength of Israel. He's drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire which devours all around. And so here in verse 3, Jeremiah speaks of the fact that God raised up his protection from Jerusalem. Spiritual warfare is bad enough when you're being protected. It must be a terrible thing and an awesome thing when that protection gets lifted in order that it might drive me out of the folly of following after the devil and his ways, so that his true colors can be seen in order to drive me back. And so here is God with the Babylonians. He had protected his people, and then he said, well, you want the Babylonians so bad, you want these other nations so bad, I'll lift my protection, and then you can see their true colors and how they'll really treat you. And of course, they were ravaged as a result of it. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow with his right hand like an adversary. He has slain all who were pleasing to his eye. On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all of her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds. He has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. And so God here became like an enemy to his children and became actively involved in their judgment and in their chastening. It is interesting, in verses 4 and 5, there's that repetition of the word like, standing, verse 4 at the beginning, like an enemy. He has bent his bow with his right hand, like an adversary. Verse 5, the Lord was like an enemy. And that word like is a qualifying statement. He never became their enemy, but he was forced to act like an enemy because of their rebellion. And so God never became their enemy. He never becomes my enemy when he chastens me and he disciplines me. But if I continue in rebellion, he must become like an enemy, like in coming against me. So their conduct against God, it compelled him to act like what he never was to them. And that was like an enemy. And so imagine what you do to a father when he has to become like an enemy to his child. I mean, that's the cruelest thing that any kid can ever do to their father. I mean, a father wants to love. A father wants to encourage. A father wants to see them do well. A father wants to be all of those things in the life of his children and more. And that's just us being evil in comparison to God. And here they force God with this heart that is as full of love and as big as can be towards them, and they force him to become like an enemy. I mean, that must have broken his heart, that rebellion and that sin, and what it forced him to do with his children that he never intended to do. I'm so glad that my kids keep me in a place where I can bless them. He has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden. And the tabernacle or the temple there, he has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary. He has given up the walls of her palace into the hands of the enemy, and they have made a noise in the house of the Lord as on the day of a set feast. And so the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And God allowed the Babylonians to destroy that temple. And he allowed them to destroy the temple because he wanted to put an end to the Sabbaths. He wanted to put an end to all of the religious activity that was going on. But it was just religious activity. There was no heart relationship towards God in their religious activity that was going on. And so it says that he has abandoned his sanctuary. In the Old King James, it says he has abhorred his sanctuary. And that's closer to what it's all about. The word there means to reject with abhorrence and to detest there in verse 7. And so he had to reject it with abhorrence and because he detested it. And so he had that the tabernacle or the temple. Violence was done to it as with a garden. Now, one of the things about a garden is that when it's no longer productive, it's no longer good for the crops have come in, everything's done with the whole deal, what do? You break out the rototiller and you just turn the whole thing upside down and everything. And that's what he allowed it to do. And that's how he handled it, as if it were a garden. I mean, the whole thing was destroyed, the temple. And I think about God in the context of all of this. The temple was not just some building that the Jews built. They built it the way that they built it because God gave them the blueprints. And the blueprints came from heaven itself. God gave those blueprints to them. And the interesting thing about the temple and the tabernacle before it is that it's a picture of heaven. It's a picture of heaven. It's a picture of the layout of heaven. And here is God as he takes this model of heaven. He wants to bless his people with that model. And he wants them to have a glimpse of heaven in their life, this side of glory. And he gives it to them. And every single one of the offerings, speaking of him and speaking of his son, all of the furnishings, all of these things that he gave, all of it, a father just flashing his heart on his children, just blessing them. And then for him to be pushed into such a place that he takes and he allows the thing to be destroyed, to be completely wiped out because he abhorred it. And the reason that he abhorred it was because he wanted to put an end to the hypocritical worship that was going on. All of the priests were doing their things. All of the Levites were doing their things. All of the people were doing their things. When Jeremiah was prophesying against the children of Israel for those 40 years, God would have them go to the temple and prophesy related to their sin because they were still going to the temple and yet their lives were filled with all of this sin and all of this idolatry. And so he stops all of the singing, he stops all of the sacrifices, he stops all of those kinds of things that were going on there. I think it's interesting that when we look at gathering together as God's people, that it's important for us to understand that we don't gather alone, that he gathers with us. And so the question isn't just, am I blessed? The question isn't just, is this a delight for me to be here? But is it a delight for God to be on the corner of 10th and F Streets? Can he not wait for the service to start here? Not here alone, but all over the world where God's people gather. But can he not wait? And the one thing that causes him to abhor the assembling together of his people is when that assembling together is filled with hypocrisy. And it's important for us as believers to consider that and the seriousness of it. It's not just, is this nice for me? Is this fun for me? Is this a delight for me? But is it a delight for God who is here also? There have been times over the years, and just a very small number of times, less than a handful of times, where we've had to discipline someone in the fellowship, where we've had to ask them to leave the fellowship because they will not forsake their sin. And what they don't understand is that God gathers here, that this is supposed to be a delight for His heart. This is supposed to be a joy for Him. And willful disobedience against the Lord causes it not to be. Now, I'm not talking about when we fail and we try hard and we fail and we fall short, or we sin and then we confess that sin and we repent of it. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. But that willful rebellion against Him, protracted against Him, and then gathering together as if that means, you know, is of no consequence in any way. And it caused God that hypocrisy to Him to abhor even the temple itself in the Old Testament. Verse 8, the Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn His hand from destroying. Therefore, He has caused the rampart and the wall to lament. They languish together. Now, those of you who are in construction, you know that you use a line to get, you want to get something straight. You want to get something well built, and so you put the chalk line out, and you flick it, and it gives you the line and the different things that you need. And so the line was drawn for construction; it was for the building of things. And God said, these people, because of their rebellion, He's had to draw a line for the destruction of the temple. In other words, it's turned them into what He never wanted to be in their lives, and so He had to destroy the wall of Jerusalem. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the nations that is taken captive. The law is no more, and her prophets find no more vision from the Lord. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. They throw dust in their heads, which was a symbol of mourning. They gird themselves with sackcloth, also a symbol of mourning. The virgins of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. And so God destroyed the physical great gates of the city of Jerusalem. And He not only destroyed the physical gates, but He destroyed her political gates, and He destroyed her spiritual gates at the same time. They didn't like His law anymore. They didn't like His word anymore. And so He said, all right, I will take My word out of your life until you long for My word. And not only long for it once again, but you long to obey it before you even know what it has to say to you and in your situations of your life. And so He removes these priests, He removes the princes, these kings, all of these men that had been put in the positions that they had been put in to be a protection to Jerusalem and the society, but they hadn't used their position to protect the society. So God says, the purpose of a gate, let me put it this way, the purpose of a gate was protection. The purpose of the prophet and the priest was protection, spiritual protection of the city and the people. The purpose of the king and the princes was protection politically, so that there would be godly rule there among the nations. So God says, listen, if you're not going to use your position to be a protection to the society inside these gates, you're not going to protect them, then what good is these dumb physical gates that are a part of the walls? This city's been destroyed from the inside because of the failure of these men to fulfill what God had called them to be, and that was protectors. They didn't take that position of the protector seriously. I think for us as men, it's very important that we take our role as protector seriously. Are our families protected? Are they protected spiritually? Are their minds protected? Yes, my children are protected. We have locks on the doors. That's not good enough. That wasn't good enough for them. Keep the locks on the doors. But protect God's call upon the lives of your children. Protect the spirituality that's budding in their life. Nurture that. I tell you, parents, it's easy to be badgered today. And it's really hard. I have such compassion upon a single parent. So difficult. It's hard enough when there's two parents to encourage one another. I read this article. Sometimes, you know, you read the paper and you're defiled. I read this article. I hate to bring it up, but I won't bring it up in all of its gory details. But this striptease party over in the Bay Area, and it was in the paper. This bring this 50 girls that are high school aged, and they hire this strip guy to come in there dressed as a cop, and he strips down and the whole thing. And the mom is standing right there. And the reason she didn't put a stop to it is she didn't want to embarrass her daughter in front of the other girls. Come on. You're the parent. You just want to get them, put their little face right in front of you. You are the parent. You're the parent. And, you know, one of the things that I said to my kids every once in a while growing up is that I don't care if you like me, but I care that you respect me as a parent and as a Christian man. I told him, you know, when you are in your early 20s, I can handle you coming back to me and saying you were too this or you were too that or you were whatever. I can handle any of that. But what I cannot handle is if you come back to me and you say, you were called by God to protect my innocence. You were called by God to protect his call upon my life, and you didn't do it. Why didn't you do it? And why did I have to pay the price for that? There's the one thing I could never want to hear from them. And God gives you grace if you failed in that area. But I say for those of us tonight, where there's a chance to still make a difference in the lives of our children, where they're young and they're at home, be the protector. Don't be afraid to be the protector. Explain your rules well. Explain the reasons why well. Disciple them, train them, but don't be afraid to be the parent. And don't be afraid to fall under God as the one that you're under authority under. I love the fact, sometimes I wish I was a woman. Well, let me change that. Let me change that, because that would be inaccurate. I virtually never wish I was a woman. But a woman has an interesting position in a marriage, in that she can fall under the authority of her husband. And the husband is in the position, in the authority structure, to protect her and to take the blows and to take the whatever that she's not intended to take. But the beautiful thing is, just as the woman is able to say concerning whatever it might be, you're going to need to talk to my husband about that. And she's free from it. It's too much for her to deal with. But it's not too much for me to deal with, because I'll wring their necks. But, I mean, in the Lord, sure, of course in the Lord. But I mean, so she has a place. But the beautiful thing is, men, God knew we needed to have that same place. And so there's that authority structure where God is over the household. And then in terms of authority, then there's the man, and then there is the husband, and then there is the wife and all. And the kids are off the graph, and the pets are nowhere. I don't care how much you love your pets. But there's that place where it's a beautiful thing for a man to say, I can't make that decision in that direction, because the one I'm under authority to has already made the decision. This is the way that has to fall right there. And if you have a beef with that, then you're going to have to talk to him about that, and then he's going to have to talk to me about that. But it doesn't close the door. They have a way to still move you, but they got to move him first. Well, good luck on that. But as men, we need that. And we need that. You think, yeah, we need that with the, you know, the hard-nosed boss. Or the hey, we need that in our families and in our household. To say, one day I'm going to stand before the Lord, and I'm going to give an account for my ministry in the raising of you, my children. And I can't make any other decision than the one that he gives me to make here. And so that's the decision that's there. And he knew that we needed that. And so to come under him for that strength. And all of a sudden, the life is easier. We agonize about so many situations and questions and decisions that are already made. And the beautiful thing is you just fall under what God has said in His Word, the decision is made, and now that thing doesn't have to torment me for the next 6 hours, or the next 6 days, or the next 6 months. And so the importance of being protectors in our children's lives. And here these, they had failed to be a protection, and because they had, the whole thing had rotted from the inside out. And that's always the way that it works as it relates to any people. Then the walls come down ever so easily. And so the importance of that protection and being that political and spiritual gate in our households. My eyes, verse 11, fail with tears. My heart is troubled. His eyes are failing with tears. And really he can't see through the tears. He's crying so much. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground. Jeremiah's grief over watching this city die and these people die so needlessly as they just would not move away from their rebellion had physical consequences upon his body. He wept. And of course, we know these kinds of things now today with our science. There's a physical impact upon the liver, upon the heart, upon all of these kinds of things. Because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city. And of course, that's the tragedy. With the failure of the parents, the failure of the adults, who are the ones that end up bearing the greatest brunt? It's the children and the infants, as Jeremiah saw them fainting on the streets of the city for lack of food. They say to their mothers, "Where's the grain and the wine?" As they swooned like the wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. And so Jeremiah, just observing the tragedy of Jerusalem, "How shall I console you? To what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you, O daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you?" And Jeremiah is just looking. He's searching everywhere for words of consolation and comfort to give to these people. But because they won't repent, there is no hope. There is no comfort to give to them until they do repent. And who can heal? Humanly speaking, he had no means of healing them. Only God could do that, but God could only do that after they repented. "Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisioned for you false prophecies and delusions." And so he exposes really laments the false prophets of Israel. And one of the failures of the false prophet here in Jeremiah's day is that they had not uncovered the iniquity of the city. They would not expose sin. They would not confront people with their sin. That's one of the great things about the Sunday nights and really on the Sunday mornings, where we just go right through the Scriptures. We just hit every single thing. We hit every word of encouragement, but we hit every rebuke. We hit every exposure of sin, and we need it. We need it. But they failed to do that. It had to all be popular. It had to all be positive, you know, and they didn't want to tell people the truth about their sin, so they made up false prophecies. And that's a tendency of the flesh, is to surround myself with people who will tell me wonderful things about myself, even if they're not true. And the Word of God is great because it's a mirror. It'll tell me the truth about myself. It never, ever ignores my sin. Now, it's interesting that when he talks there in the verse 14, and he says, they're false and deceptive visions. The word deceptive means whitewashed. And the idea was, you got a building, and the building has a major crack in it. Well, let's see. We just need to find any number of those in this building. But it has a major crack in it. And the crack is dangerous to the whole structure. It's dangerous to those that are living in the structure. And somebody needs to go, you know, that crack, anybody notice that's a pretty big crack in the building? Anybody knows that crack's getting like bigger by the week? And this thing's going to collapse sooner or later? Well, these false prophets, they had an idea. They didn't like to deal with cracks like that. Oh, don't tell the people we've got cracks here. Everything's got to look just right. And so what they would do is they would just whitewash it. They'd just put a little plaster on it, and they'd cover the whole thing up. The problem is that when there's a structural problem, that doesn't solve the problem, and ultimately the collapse is going to come. And that's what they did. They failed to reveal the problems, the sin that was in the society, and instead they just kept covering up the things. But the result is always fatal. The end is always a disaster. All who pass by, verse 15, clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, we have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we've waited for. We have found it and we have seen it. And so all of their enemies, when they were judged, all of their enemies piled on. All these nations that they had essentially prostituted themselves to. And they thought, oh, these nations, they're true blue to us. You know, they'll be loyal to us. We're worshiping their gods and all that kind of stuff. And the first chance that these nations had, the first opportunity to mock them for the folly of leaving their God, they took advantage of doing that. And the Lord would never do that to us. But, the others will do it. But to stay with, I guess the idea is to, as a child of God, when we've made a stand for the Lord, and people know that what we were about was the Lord, and what we're supposed to be about is the Lord, you know, we fit into a different category in their minds from then on. Especially those that know, that raised up in church, never gave their life to the Lord, but they know what we're doing isn't what it's about. And so when that trouble comes and that discipline comes, that chastening comes, that fall comes in the thing, and we think, oh boy, you know, we've been accepted in this group and they're going to take care of us through thick and thin, and it doesn't pan out because we haven't been accepted in that group. The group that we're supposed to be involved in is the Lord and with His body. And so there's a lot of disappointment that comes in that, where people think, oh yeah, this is... No, they're really for me. And then you find out that isn't the case when push comes to shove. Verse 17, the Lord has done what He purposed. He has fulfilled His word, which He commanded in the days of old. He has thrown down and has not pitied. He has caused your enemy to rejoice over you. He has exulted over the horn of your adversaries. God had, as Jeremiah said here, He's fulfilled His word. And God had spoken to the children of Israel hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years earlier in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is five sermons with one theme. And the theme was obedience. And over and over and over and over again, God pounded home through Moses the importance of obedience. That to live the life of obedience to the Lord is to live a blessed life. But to live a life in rebellion to God, that's a path that's cursed. There's no life to be found on it. And you know, you read the book of Deuteronomy and you think, come on, Moses. I mean, couldn't it have been like a three-part sermon or a three-part series on disobedience, or just one sermon on disobedience? I mean, five times do you have to pound it home again and again and again and again? And he did, because even at five times, they didn't listen. And one of the great things about Moses, by the time he delivered those messages, he was an old man. He's 120 years old. And not going to be leading the children of Israel into the land. One of the great things that happens for a teacher of the Word of God is the longer you do it, is the less you look for the fanciful things in the passages. Sometimes, you know, when you're young and you're starting out in teaching, you think, you look at a passage, you go, everybody knows that. I mean, here's this passage. All it's doing is just telling God's people that they need to obey and the importance of obedience. There's no way I'm going in the pulpit and just saying something that basic. Forget it. Is that we got to look for some nugget, some little thing that really shines on the deal. And then, you know, you serve the Lord for a while. And you realize how often I need to hear the same things over and over again. And how often God's people need to hear the same things over and over again because we have such a capacity to forget. And so God had said, if you rebel against me, and he even told them, I know you will. He said, it's going to be a disaster. The interesting thing for our lives as Christians and for every single human being on the face of the planet, our word or our lives are always going to prove the word of God true. I guarantee there's not a single person in this room, your life is never going to prove that word false. We're not going to all get into heaven and find out that a verse has been scratched out of the Bible because your life proved it wrong, or anyone else in the world. Heaven and earth is going to pass away, but this word is never going to pass away. Not one sentence, not one precept, not one line, not one jot, not one tittle is going to be passed away of this word. Our lives are going to confirm the veracity or the truthfulness of this word, but we're going to prove it in one of two ways. That the life of obedience is a blessing, or we're going to prove that the life of disobedience is a curse. But we're going to prove it to be true. And God would much rather that we prove it the former to be true, because that's what he longs to do, is to bless people. Their heart cried out to the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief. Give your eyes no rest. And so Jeremiah now starts to exhort Zion or exhort Jerusalem. And the first thing he does is he gives them a call to weep. He says, get together and just start weeping over this situation. Give yourself no relief. Give your eyes no rest. And then in verse 19, he gives them a call to pray. Arise, cry out in the night. At the beginning of the watches, pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward him. For the life of your young children who faint from hunger at the head of every street. Now, in this call to prayer, he tells them to cry out at the beginning of the watches. In other words, be praying to God now without ceasing. And then he tells them to lift up their hands toward God. In other words, now, when you come to God in prayer, they were going through all these rituals and blah, 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 and I can do it as good as anybody else, you know, and just this mindless talk that sounds spiritual, but they disconnected from God a long time earlier. He says, now lift up your hands, surrender to God, surrender to his will. And sometimes where you go to Jerusalem today and you go to the Western Wall, and you'll see the Orthodox Jews, they'll be up against the wall, and they'll be shaking like this up against the wall. You see them stop on the street corners and do that. They've been doing it for thousands of years now. And we say, why do they shake like that? And the idea is that they're worshiping God with the totality of their being, with all of their heart, all their mind, all of their soul, and all of their strength. But you've got to be in a relationship with them, born again, for that to make any kind of a difference. But there was that idea where Jeremiah is saying, even in the physical, whatever you're doing, let even that communicate worship to God and surrender to God. And there's a passage here at this where he says, pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. I've always liked that. And in one of the Psalms, David writes that. And he talks about pouring out our heart before the Lord. And the word there, in the original language, it means to spill. It means to spill. In other words, you've got a glass of water there on the table, and you spill it. Were any of you plagued with that as children, with doing that? You get these klutzo kids, and they do that. In our household, it always went in spurts. And we weren't trying to drive our dad crazy, but sometimes it'd be, you know, several glasses of milk all at once. But one of the things about a spill is when the glass goes over, what happens? All the water comes out. All the water comes out. And that's what Jeremiah is calling them to do, and that is to express the totality of their heart, the deepest things, the things they hadn't said to God in a long time. In other words, just pour your heart out to God. Forget all of your chanting. Forget all of your this, all of your learned prayers, all of your this and that. Just be real with Him and pour your heart out to God. Let's get back to reality. And that's what He was calling them to do in their prayers. And then He says there in verse 20, "See, O Lord, and consider." And now this is Jerusalem speaking to the Lord. "To whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring and the children that they've cuddled?" And of course, in the siege of the Babylonians against Jerusalem, it was an 18-month siege. And at the end of the siege, the women were eating their children. The cannibalism that was going on there, and still would not turn from their sin. Wouldn't do it. And so, but now they're complaining against God. Should this happen? Should the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord God? Is it right that the priest and the prophet were killed right in the temple? Young and old, they lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You've slain them in the day of your anger. You've slaughtered and not pitied. You've invited as to a feast day the terrors that surround me in the day of the Lord's anger. There was no refuge or survivor. Those whom I have born and brought up, my enemies have destroyed. And so here is Zion following that their destruction, and they're really, really upset with God. And they're angry against God, and so they bring their accusations against Him. God, did this need to happen with the women? Did this need to happen with the children? Did this need to happen with the priest and the prophet and the young and the old and all of this kind of stuff? And there's a lot of bitterness that they're bringing forth here. There's a lot of anger that they're bringing forth to the Lord. And you know, I read some of the commentaries as it relates to this, and sometimes they'll try to minimize what's happening here, but there's no doubt about it. These people are expressing their anger and their bitterness over what has happened to them there. But you know, it's not unusual in the Old Testament scriptures. In many of the Psalms, the psalmist begins with confusion. He begins with sometimes even anger as it relates to the Lord or something. And he begins just to speak his heart. He begins to communicate to God. And before the psalm is over, he's worshiping the Lord. And all of a sudden, things start to fall into place between him and God. All of a sudden, he starts to see things for the way that they really are. And perspective starts to be gained in the situation. And God is gracious enough to work people through that. The big thing is this. As long as there's reality there, it's like God could have maybe for someone else, he'd come in and deal with them and stop that kind of something being said to him because it was inappropriate in that way. But here he lets them talk. Here he lets them talk. Why? Because for the first time in 40 years, he hears something real from their heart. And now he can begin to make progress. And they will end up changing how they see things, and they'll end up taking responsibility for what had happened in Jerusalem. But here they bring forth their anger and their complaint against the Lord.